Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Happy Cinco de Mayo, everybody. My son pointed out to me yesterday that it was Star Wars Day. May the 4th be with you. And on that note, satirist Christopher Buckley is here now with his new collection of essays. He kind of got it in a delayed fashion.
All I can say, Brian, is your previous guest, Cardinal Caspar, parent, I'm told, has a blurb on his book by Pope Francis.
You're getting a little ahead of yourself.
I wish I had a blurb on my book from Pope Francis, is all I can say.
Let's see.
I'm not sure that'll ever happen. No, it is a blurbless book, as you'll see, but attractively packaged, I think, and very reasonably priced.
And called. But enough about you. And despite the title, Chris's snark about things like an imagined Al-Qaeda newscast and a President Donald Trump inaugural address, despite those things, there are also more serious thoughts here, including tributes to Ray Bradbury and Christopher Hitchens and the importance to our world of the novels Catch-22 and Moby Dick. Can I ask you about your upbringing? Your father, William F. Buckley, had a sense of humor. He flashed it on the show a few times.
He did. He was, in fact, well known for his sense of humor.
But people think of him first as a seriously sober conservative intellectual. How much political humor did you grow up with at your dinner table, in addition to what I'm sure were many serious political rants?
Well, it was an interesting dinner table. I wasn't really granted admission to it until I had reached about the age of 13, at which point I still didn't have very much to offer. He was a my dad was to use a phrase that my late friend Christopher Hitchens, to whom the book is indeed dedicated, that wonderful phrase, my father was an homme sérieux, the French word for a serious man. But he was also a man who loved to laugh, and he never failed to see the humor in things. The only time actually his humor ever failed him was on matters of religion. I'm sure the previous guest might approve of that. But he was the only time he ever didn't tolerate japery was when it came to his beloved mother church, but anything else was fair game. And he often pointed fun at himself.
But I actually saw a line on your Wikipedia page that said you had an easier time relating to your mother growing up because she got you on religion. Does that reflect anything real?
That line in my Wikipedia page was the reason 2 weeks ago I finally caved and got my own website. And it was really a reaction. That Wikipedia page also has me born on Christmas Eve, which is only 3 months off, and being a Canadian citizen. I thought it might be time to correct the record.
Welcome to America, Chris.
Welcome to America. Thank you. And it's good to be part of the 21st century. Finally.
So did you grow up wanting to satirize one side or another? Oh, I'm sorry. You're going to give me a serious answer to that
question.
Well,
I was going to say my mother, bless her heart, who was Canadian, in fact, and was nominally Anglican, or was, as they are called here, Episcopalians, I could discuss certain things with her that were a little out of bounds with my dad. But it is a gross simplification to say that I got, as Wikipedia avers, that I got along better with my mother than my father because I got to go about religion.
Wasn't Jesus also actually born about 3 months from Christmas? But
well,
that's another
as
show.
A matter of fact, yes, probably the one thing I have in common with our Lord and Savior.
Did you grow up wanting to satirize one side or another, or did you look at the whole cast of characters around you in Washington politics and see it as a big, ragged, but somehow unified circus ripe for the biting word processor?
I like to think I've been an equal opportunity abuser of our elected officials. If you go through the book, I think you'll find as much fun is poked at people on the right as people on the left. People on the right I've always found to be actually funnier. I mean, I think it's easier – this is a broad generalization, but it's probably easier to lampoon right-wingers than left-wingers.
As Stephen Colbert was saying just the other day – no, I'm kidding.
Well, he's done a
– But he's made a career.
He's done a brilliant job of just doing that. I mean, try to imagine, if you will, Stephen Colbert doing left shtick. Rather than right shtick. I think that's a – I think that would be a harder sell.
But there's a difference between saying right-wingers are funnier and right-wingers are easier to make fun of.
Yeah. No, I'm not making the former point.
Not making the former
no,
point.
No.
So when you write a line like this about Frank Langella, taken from the book, it seems somehow logical that an actor who became famous for playing Dracula should have his greatest success playing Richard Nixon, no disrespect to Dracula intended. Would something like that have become the subject of tisking in your boyhood home?
No, no, not at all. My we had a good many laughs about Richard Nixon. One time during the Nixon administration, the phone rang on – it was Sunday morning about 8 o'clock. My mother answered, and she thought this was a little tad early for a phone call on Sunday.
I'd agree.
And the voice on the other end said, Mr. Buckley, please, it's the president calling. And my mother said, the president of what? Well, our country, ma'am.
So, and it was Richard Nixon?
It was indeed Richard Nixon, yeah. Yeah. What could he have been calling about?
You don't know. I want to know the end of the story.
This is lost to history, but there are a few other.
Are you free for brunch at 9:30, something like that? No, it wasn't that.
Something, must have been something like that, yeah.
Do you find that either liberals or conservatives take being satirized more in stride?
Well, I can give you an anecdote. My first novel was a novel called The White House Mess, and it was I worked at the White House as a speechwriter for George Herbert Walker Bush when he was vice president, and as I became fascinated by White House memoirs, which is a subgenre, and anyone who's ever worked at the White House for more than 5 minutes writes an 800-page book.
And these days they get released while the president is still in office.
Exactly. But these books were once a no-no. The first person ever to do it was a former Eisenhower aide named John Emmett Hughes, and everyone was scandalized, even though it was, by today's standards, absolutely chaste. Anyway, I wrote as my first I thought it would be kind of fun to send up that form, the White House memoir. So my first novel was a novel called The White House Mess, and it was a parody White House memoir. This came out in 1986. It began, the novel, on Inauguration Day 1989 with Reagan being the outgoing president. In this book, I had him having gone dotty, and the new president arrives to escort the outgoing president up to the Capitol, and Reagan is still in pajamas. He's decided it's too nice a day to leave. How weirdly prescient that was, and I don't mean to make
I was
fun
say,
of
all say this is fiction.
No, but anyway, so that here I was sort of poking fun at a sitting president, and I had served in his administration. And it was that that first chapter that sort of caused the book to get a certain amount of notice. To answer your question, and I then got a little bit nervous. And then about a month later, I got a handwritten note from the President of the United States saying, oh, I'm so pleased at the success of your new book. And I was pleased to play a small part in it. So there's your answer.
So at least Ronald Reagan, with
Ronald
his
Reagan had,
showbiz
had
background,
a
took his
reliable
in
sense of humor.
Christopher Buckley, our guest on WNYC, his new collection of essays called "But Enough About You," and you open the book with a Somerset Maugham quote, that says, make the reader laugh and he will think you a trivial fellow, but bore him the right way and your reputation is assured. That doesn't leave a writer much wiggle room, does it?
I love that. I both love and hate that quote. And as I think I say in the first line, I'll cop to being a trivial fellow. I've never had any illusions about that. But I can say with a straight face that my goal has never been to bore the reader. But I was arrested by that quote. I think it, but I go on to the height of vanity, quoting the first page of my own book. But I was on a panel once with Wendy Wasserstein and Steve Martin and Bruce McCall, all of whom are very, very seriously funny people. Mm-hmm. And Wendy Wasserstein, who was a lovely girl, said that I think her first success was a comedy, and someone had said to her, you know, you really ought to try something serious someday.
And said it to you?
No, to her.
Ah.
And her reply was, oh, you think writing funny is easy? You try it.
But not just writing funny is easy. If the remark was you should try something serious someday, I wonder if you see your work as making important political or cultural points or simply as providing comic relief or poking fun, because some of the great satirists would certainly say they were in it to make larger points, to be serious.
I wouldn't. I'm happy to hear you suggest it. It would be fatal for me to say, yeah, I have a serious agenda. I was once – the term satirist is a tricky one.
Different from comedian.
Well, yeah, it is. It's what my dad would have called an out-of-town word, you know, or a $10 word. I was once I do a certain amount of public speaking, and I was doing a speaking to a civic audience in Ohio somewhere. This is one of those things where it's 11 o'clock in the morning. You're speaking at the Civic Center. Most of the audience are gray or blue-haired ladies. There are 1,000 of them and 5 husbands who've been sort of dragged along. Come on, Elmer, you're going to get some culture this morning. And are sitting there hating it. And the my host, who was an utterly gracious person, and you know they're nicer than we are out in the Midwest. They referred to me as a satirist, and not only once, but she kept coming back to it. You know, it's not every day we get a satirist, you know, here in Akron.
Did she just not know the word?
I think it was an unfamiliar word, which tells you that it is indeed an out of town word, or maybe actually it's not an out of town word. But she said it so many times that I was left to wonder if, you know, why if the people in the audience were sort of wondering why the lecture committee had invited a sex fiend to address them at 11 o'clock in the morning. But no, I think of myself to the extent I try not to think of myself, but as an entertainer. I mean, but it is, I think, a mistake to assume that because something is funny or is being made fun of, that there might not be an underlining point to it.
Of course. And again, I would use the example of Stephen Colbert. There's the comedian who might stand up somewhere and take cheap shots for one-liner kinds of laughs at anybody from any political persuasion or whatever, and then there's somebody who's actually trying to make a set of serious points. But before we run out of time, I definitely want to touch on Christopher Hitchens, to whom the book is dedicated. And again, you know, one with only a casual knowledge of you and him might not have guessed that the son of William Buckley might have grown up to have such a great 30-year relationship with the liberal lion until he flipped over the Iraq War. Christopher Hitchens, how did you get to know each other and what did you really bond over?
I loved him right from the start. I met him in 1977 in England, and I was in awe of him. He was an awe-inspiring kind of guy. But he also, Christopher, for his fierce intellect, he had a very warm heart. And for whatever reason, we bonded and spent a lot of time together. We once had a 10-and-a-half-hour-long lunch.
Wow.
He loved to lunch. We sat down at 1 o'clock at Cafe Milano, and we left at 11:30. Somewhere around 8 or 9, I think, if memory serves, and my memory is a bit dim of that event, he said to me, "Do you think we should order some more food?"
I hope you left the waitress a good tip at the end of that lunch.
I have no memory of that. I went home and spent the next 2 weeks on a morphine drip and with my head packed in ice. He went home and wrote a biography of George Orwell. He had a formidable constitution. And his death was, I think, all the more piquant for happening far too soon, and his fatal diagnosis of stage 4 esophageal cancer occurred almost eerily simultaneously with the release of his autobiography, which I commend to your listeners. It's called Hitch 22.
And one more thing. You wrote the introduction to the 50th anniversary edition of Joseph Heller's Catch 22.
I did.
Excerpted here. Looking back on that, it was an anti-war book that predated the anti-Vietnam War movement by a few years. And it was an anti-war book about World War II, which almost nobody in this country ever objected to. So was Heller ahead of his time, or was he just off on his own thing?
Well, every genius is, I think, off on his own thing. There's a marvelous saying, talent does what it can, genius does what it must. Obviously, I mean, Joe spent 7 or 8 years working on that book. It was published in 1961. And on the threshold of the adventure that became our national tragedy, it became probably by coincidence an anti-Vietnam novel, but it is generically really an anti-war novel, but it lives on, and which speaks to, I think, the universality of its theme. It would be a mistake to just consider it an anti-war movie book. Sorry.
And then movie, a very powerful movie, actually. I saw the Catch 22.
An odd movie that didn't quite work but was eminently watchable. I mean, look at who was in it. Alan Arkin, John Voight, Orson Welles, everyone. And directed by the incomparable Mike Nichols, of course.
Right. And I guess we shouldn't get bogged down in a conversation of whether it was effective or not, but I guess I thought
But enough about
showing the – that's right. Showing the injured Snowden and Alan Arkin in that context. Anyway, for another day. But enough about Catch-22. Christopher Buckley's new book is called But Enough About You. It's a collection of essays. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, why the kidnappings of hundreds of girls in Nigeria has had such a hard time getting media attention, why it had such a hard time getting the president of Nigeria to say anything about it until this weekend. Imagine if those kidnappings had happened in the United States. We'll dig into the Nigeria story after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.